Capture the night.
Direct from the entertainment capital of the world, fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada. It's Jerry Pippen with entertainment news, views, and interviews.
Dr. Michael Green is with us. He's a professor of history at the Community College of Southern Nevada. And also, is it okay if I call you Michael or Mike? Or
whatever you feel like calling me.
You do a few things over at UNLV as well, right?
I teach in the Honors College and for the History Department. In fact, this semester I just finished a course on the history of Las Vegas.
And that's the reason we're talking to you, even though you have a very interesting book out. It's far from Las Vegas history, and that's Freedom, Union, and Power, Lincoln and History. His party during the Civil War, which is a pretty interesting book.
Well, thank you. That was my dissertation in graduate school, and I didn't really think I'd make it back to Las Vegas to teach. And when I did, it isn't that I abandoned the Civil War era. I'm still working on all of that. But I found that there's so much Las Vegas history to work on, and it's too good to pass up.
That's true. I spent many years there, and still I'm out there frequently. It's quite a place, quite a colorful history. 100 years, is this really 100 years for the anniversary of Las Vegas, or did they just kind of manufacture that?
Well, I hate to admit the answer to that question is kind of yes and no. But I'm more for the yes, that it really is the 100th anniversary, and here's why. On May 15, 1905, there was an auction. In fact, it was right near the Plaza Hotel, used to be the Union Plaza, downtown near Main and Fremont. Of course, the hotel wasn't there then, but they had an auction stand.
I guess they had the railroad tracks there even then.
They had the railroad tracks. Railroad service had just started, and the co-owners of the railroad were the Union Pacific and Senator William Andrews Clark, who was a Montana copper baron.
I bet you that's how Clark County got its name.
That is how it got its name, and I have to throw in there was another Clark out here, no relation, named Ed Clark. And apparently Ed Clark talked the legislature into creating the county by sending them a case of whiskey. You can still get things done. But anyway, they decided to have an auction of the land that Clark had bought. And he had bought it 3 years before, 1902, from a widow, Helen Stewart, who had close to 2,000 acres. She sold him about 1,800 acres of it for $55,000. And what made Las Vegas appealing was that it had a lot of something it doesn't have nearly so much of now, water. We're the Meadows, Las Vegas in Spanish. And Clark wanted the water for what was called a division point where he'd have the railroad repair shops. So the idea in having this auction was to create a little town that would provide residences and businesses for the repair workers and for the passengers who'd be stopping off as well. So May 15 was the day of the auction, and that's the day we have long celebrated as Las Vegas's birthday. But of course, you can talk to Native Americans. The Paiutes have been here for well over 1,000 years, and you can add to that that there were some settlers here in the 1850s. But the real beginning of the city as we come to know it is May 15, 1905. So, happy birthday. We're 100.
Now, you talk about Stewart, and there's a Stewart Street downtown. And the main drag there is Fremont Street, and I guess Fremont had a lot to do with this, too.
Old John did. He went on to be a hotel, a street, and an experience. He was a map maker for the United States Army. And in 1844, he came through Las Vegas in the process of exploring the West. So you could say he literally put us on the map. And his report became a bestseller. His wife, Jessie Benton Fremont, who was, I don't mean this unkindly toward John, but she was the real brains of the outfit. She edited the report. And among what's interesting to me about it, among the readers of the report was Brigham Young. And when Brigham Young headed west with the Mormon Church in 1846 and 47, he had that report. And he had that report in mind when he sent missionaries here in the 1850s. So a lot of what we talk about with Las Vegas history, you could say, does start with John Fremont.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned Brigham Young and the Mormon culture. That's pretty important in Las Vegas history.
Very much so. The Mormons were, I guess, technically the first non-Native American settlers. Young sent some missionaries here in 1855 with the idea that he wanted to have what was called the Mormon Road, or a Mormon trail, from Salt Lake to Southern California. And if you look at the history of the Mormon Church, over the past quarter of a century since it started under Joseph Smith, Mormons often had been shot at. Young wanted to make sure that Mormons had safe havens. And, of course, Mormons long have proselytized, gone out, gone door to door, and the idea of Christianizing the Native Americans who were here was also part of what Young was up to. So Young starts things, and there had been considerable Mormon settlement on the Utah-Nevada line. In fact, at one point, there were Mormon settlers in Nevada who thought they were still in Utah. Didn't have a sign saying, welcome to Nevada.
Well, it's hard to tell the difference of the landscape there.
The only difference I can find is that there is no difference.
Yeah, yes, you got a good point there, Dr. Green. We're talking about history of Las Vegas, and we mentioned the Mormons. We talked about the early settlers of the railroad. We haven't mentioned the Mafia.
And they come in a little later. In terms of organized crime, a lot of people think that it all begins with Bugsy Siegel. And I didn't realize this for many years, but Bugsy Siegel's initials pretty well cover that.
B.S.
Yep.
In other words, well, I've heard many times, we've done a lot of shows about this, and Siegel and the early Mafia guys really were pretty good at, image control?
Very good at image control. These were guys, bear in mind, that a lot of them like to fly under the radar. One of the real founders of modern Las Vegas, Mo Dalitz, who had had a lot of connections in his time.
Yeah, wasn't that over at the Dunes? Or
Dalitz was at the Desert Inn.
Oh, Desert Inn, right, okay.
He had had a place called the Beverly Club in Kentucky and another place in Cleveland on Mayfield Road, so they were known as the Mayfield Road Gang. And Dalitz once said that he'd never known that his casino operations back there were illegal because there were so many politicians and policemen in there. He figured that it was all right because the entire community was coming in, so what was their beef? Well, there's some truth to that. You know, it went on in a lot of places, but they had to pay people off to be able to operate. Las Vegas gave them the opportunity to avoid doing that. But, you know, it's funny to me that back in the late 20s, this guy came out here to work as a dealer, and he later opens up a little place on Highway 91, which is the Strip, the road to Los Angeles. And it was called the Paradise. And this guy carried with him a pocket watch given to him by one of his best friends ever, Al Capone. Well, you know, this kind of suggests that Capone had an interest in the place in the 20s.
That was a long time before.
But Bugsy does deserve some credit. What happened with him, he came out to Hollywood in the mid-30s, and part of the story is romantic, and part of the story is not, but both are actually true. He came out west in part because he wanted to be an actor, and he did a screen test. And he had one of the great lines ever about the early movies. He said something like this, that if a midget like Edward G. Robinson can play a gangster, why not the real thing?
Good point, but I guess he got educated when he got to Hollywood.
Well, he did, and he was a very close friend of George Raft, and Raft was always playing gangsters. And I've always had this image that Siegel wanted to be with Raft to learn how to look like an actor. And Raft wanted to be with Siegel to learn how to look like a mobster.
You're probably true.
By the time it was done, I think Siegel was studying Raft to learn how to look more like a gangster, and Raft was trying to find out how to look more like an actor by hanging around with Siegel. I don't know quite how all that worked, but see, that was part of the reason he came west. But the other reason was that the boys back east wanted in on the action in Hollywood, and Bugsy, in fact, got a great deal of power over the stagehands union. He had a great deal of pull in Hollywood in the 30s. And in 1940, 41, I believe it was the summer of 41, though it may have been 40, we're a little uncertain of the dates, partly because of a Woody Allen line. Woody Allen once said that the Mafia saves a lot of money on office supplies.
You got a good point.
Bugsy and Meyer came up to Las Vegas. And when Meyer Lansky got out of the car, he basically looked around and said, well, I'm leaving. I'm not staying here, but we're going to build hotel casinos here. And the image is that it was Siegel's idea, and later Lansky made pretty clear it was his idea. Well, Lansky was around to take the credit, so maybe it really was. But Siegel and Lansky and their friends got involved in race wire reports, providing the horse racing results through a wire service to the local casinos. And that was their foothold. And they went on to invest in some downtown places, before they went out onto the strip. Now, the flamingo was apparently not really Bugsy's idea. It was really the idea of a Hollywood businessman named Billy Wilkerson, who, like Siegel, liked to hang around with celebrities. Wilkerson published The Hollywood Reporter, and he owned a couple of night spots, and he wanted a place in Las Vegas for his Hollywood friends. He also had learned something that, frankly, Steve Wynn later said, I think in the pithiest way possible. Steve Wynn once said, if you want to make money in a casino, own it.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, you're better off on the house side of the table. And Wilkerson was himself a gambler, and he was losing too much money gambling. Well, he tried to get the hotel built, and he was still losing too much money gambling. He gambled away part of the profits. And Siegel, who'd been a silent partner, stepped in. And so the Flamingo really isn't Bugsy's idea, although he certainly realized the possibilities, and he got in on the action.
You know, you talk about downtown first. Everyone thinks about, the original old man Binion down there, but he was actually a late comer in the 50s, right?
Well, he opens up the Horseshoe in 51.
Uh-huh.
He'd come to Las Vegas around 1946, and I love his version, which is apparently an accurate version, of why he came here. He had been involved in illegal gambling and the rackets in Dallas, and his soundbite on the subject was, my sheriff got defeated.
Uh-huh.
Well, the city was letting him operate, and occasionally a reform administration would come in and shut him down, and they found out that the fines that Binion and the other operators were paying were helping to keep the city in business. So they were better off letting the illegal gambling operate, fine it, and get revenue. But Binion, another Benny. Benny Binion came out here in 46 and was involved in a couple of downtown places, but the Horseshoe gets started in 51. And, you know, a lot of people don't appreciate how innovative Binion was. He was the first guy downtown to put carpeting through the whole casino.
It literally was really rustic down there.
It really was. I mean, the old notion of sawdust on the floors shouldn't suggest that they were poor and crying poverty, but they were emulating the old-fashioned Old West saloons in a lot of ways. And in fact, downtown's theme, really up to when Binion is starting in 51, 20 years after legalization, was the Old West.
Yeah, I think that cowboy sign there on the old Pioneer thing goes all the way back to there.
It goes back to the early 50s, Vegas Vic saying, howdy, partner.
Uh-huh.
And of course, he had his girlfriend across the way, Vegas Vicky. We can't forget Vegas Vicky, who was much, in my opinion, more attractive than Vegas Vic.
Yeah, well, probably. I'm inclined to agree with you.
I co-wrote the Centennial History of the City, and they have a rendition of Vegas Vicky on the cover. And I was saying, you know, most history books do not have Vegas Vicky on the cover, but that's Vegas, so we're going to take advantage of it.
That's right.
But Binion also was the first to send limousines to the airport to get his customers. And his motto was, treat big people like they're big people and little people like they're big people.
Which really works.
It really works, and it's why, while I admire Steve Wynn, no end, and Gary Loveman at Harrah's, and they're both considered incredibly innovative, and they are.
Now Wynn showed up with the Bingo Palace, is that right?
Wynn showed up with Bingo.
Okay.
Not the Bingo Palace.
Okay, that was the old Sahara, I guess.
The old Club Bingo turned into the Sahara.
Yeah.
And that was kind of strange, because that was a fellow named Milton Prell, who originally came out of Butte, Montana, where he'd been involved in illegal casinos. And you don't think of Butte, Montana as a gambling center. But the fact is, virtually any city of any substance had some sort of gambling going on. I always think of a song from Guys and Dolls, the world's oldest permanent floating crap game. There's always one going on somewhere. And Prell had gone out to L.A. and been in business. And the Sahara was, by the standards of its time, very clean.
Yeah, by clean, you're not talking about the floors.
The other thing that's a kind of interesting link to the present is that the Sahara was the first hotel that Sam Boyd invested in. And Boyd had been here as a dealer and then a shift boss and a pit boss and so on. And the Sahara really marks the beginning of his rise to where today Boyd Gaming, run by his son Bill, is one of the major gaming corporations in the world. And it was not simply a question of inheriting Daddy's money. Bill Boyd himself was and is a very shrewd and able businessman. But Wynn actually came here as a 10-year-old in 1952 with his dad, who ran bingo games back east. And he wanted to get in on the action here, and he went under. He couldn't get licensed, and he couldn't make money. But Steve Wynn, as a kid, fell in love with this city, and he was determined to come back. And after he'd gone through the Wharton School at Penn and married Elaine, he came back to Las Vegas. And not to use a cliche that's really, really true in most cases, but the rest is history.
Yeah, that's true. And he played his part in renovating downtown with the Golden Nugget and getting Frank Sinatra in there.
Oh, very much so. And, you know, Wynn, it's funny, he would hang around Benny Binion, soaking up wisdom. And that's why I say, when we talk about innovation today, of course it's innovative, but they're really not doing anything that different in customer service than Binion did. But Wynn got in on downtown in the early 70s, and he was only in his early 30s at the time, and the Golden Nugget was your basic downtown.
Yeah, it was a country place, and before Wynn took it over.
Another Western-oriented place, and, you know, just a casino. Nothing special. Successful, but not setting the world on fire. And the best way to look at the Golden Nugget, there are some nice places downtown, but the Golden Nugget looks kind of like a strip resort that got lost and moved downtown.
That's true.
It's substantially bigger. And Wynn also, of course, went into Atlantic City in the late 70s and early 80s, and that helped him out because that helped him financially and gave him, you might say, the beachhead from which to sign Sinatra. And I think what's funny about Wynn is that his first national splash, in a lot of ways, is with Sinatra. And I wish I had a tape of this, but Wynn used to do his own commercials. And I get a little nervous whenever I see a business owner doing his own commercials because I think it means I'm about to be offered a used car.
Yeah, I understand.
And Steve Wynn's a salesman. Don't ever question that. But he used to do his own commercials for the Golden Nugget, and I'll never forget the Sinatra commercial because he's saying, I've just signed Frank Sinatra to be at my hotel, and it's such a great thrill for me, and now I'm going to get to meet him. And he says, Mr. Sinatra, I'm Steve Wynn. And Frank says, who?
I think I remember that commercial.
Just a great ad. But here was this clean-cut, fresh-faced young guy who was standing the image of Las Vegas on its head because the thought a lot of people had was something along the lines of, yeah, but we and the boys been out on a contract. You know, that the attitude was these were a bunch of thugs.
You do that very well. I guess that's because you grew up in Las Vegas.
Grew up here. I had to learn it.
In fact, you graduated from high school there.
I went through the Clark County school system and went on to the university.
Well, you ended up in Columbia University, too, in New York.
I got my Ph.D. there, and I'm not kidding when I say this. They eventually raised the admission standards after I got in there. Hope it had nothing to do with me, but they really did raise them. And actually, I was part of a class of people who've gone on to do some important history books. A friend of mine did a book on Gerald Ford, and you wouldn't think, you know, Gerald Ford? You know, who? To a lot of people.
Well, he had quite a history there, Speaker of the House.
Very important in the House, uh-huh. And of course, as president. It's kind of funny that he plays a role in Nevada. I mean, everybody plays a role in Nevada.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you about Richard Nixon's brother.
Richard Nixon's brother and Gerald Ford, too, but I'll tell you my Gerald Ford story.
Okay.
My Jerry story.
Okay.
When he was running for his full term as president, because, of course, he was appointed by Nixon to be vice president and then tried to move up, or did move up when Nixon resigned and he wanted to win his own term, there was the revolt in the Republican Party, and Ronald Reagan ran against him. And Ronald Reagan's best friend was Paul Laxalt, who was a senator from Nevada. And Laxalt, by his presence in the Reagan camp, did a lot to make Nevada look better. The idea being, you know, here's this guy who looks, and he was, the son of a Basque sheep herder. He had owned a casino, but he doesn't look like a mob type. And he was very good for our image. And he ran Reagan's campaign against Ford, which wasn't successful. But he did then play a significant role in Reagan's two successful campaigns for the presidency. And say what you will of Reagan, and there's a lot I could say about Reagan, beyond the fact that he played Las Vegas.
Yeah, I remember, in fact, we talked about that. I don't know if he was a hit.
Yeah, Damon Runyon had a great term, the medium hello.
Yeah.
To describe how critics greeted you. I think Reagan got the medium hello.
Okay.
But you know, just the Republican Party to the present, with its policies, has affected Las Vegas. We're part of the world, after all. But it's funny that the campaign against Ford is what helped put Nevada on the map in a different way by, again, giving us a more respectable look. The funny thing is, when you allude to Nixon, you're alluding to Howard Hughes.
Yes, I am, and we hadn't got to him yet, and I knew we would.
Gotta do Hughes. Yep. And the funny thing about that is that Hughes brought us great respectability. The notion that this mega wealthy man, this multi-billionaire, I guess, was willing to buy in Las Vegas was a great signal to the rest of the world that Nevada was trying to clean up its act.
Well, and there had to be some political moves there because, correct me if I'm not wrong, but Hughes is responsible for corporations being able to be licensed. Wasn't it before you had to be individually?
Before Hughes, you did have to have individual ownership. Corporations were not welcome, and Hughes plays a role in that. It was open for discussion before Hughes got to Las Vegas. But I think it is important because his presence is so helpful to the city's image, really the state's image, that it encourages the willingness of others to have corporate gaming. And what I can mention about that, we had a governor in the 50s and 60s, Grant Sawyer, who was very progressive, a big supporter of civil rights, did a lot to reform our gaming regulation and clean up the state. Sawyer opposed corporate gaming, and he said, if you let corporations in, the mob will find a way to turn them into fronts. And he was right, they did. Well, Laxalt defeated him for governor and supported corporate gaming and said, Sawyer may be right, but the fact is that the corporations will drive out the mob. And Laxalt was right.
Yeah, in fact, I kind of noticed that... The reason the mafia is not that big anymore, in my opinion, out there, is the corporate guys can be just as ruthless.
Which mob do you prefer?
Well, there's a story about the Tropicana, though. The mob never really got paid for that thing.
Well, you know, the Tropicana is a wild story, and I'm working on a book with a guy who used to run the Tropicana.
Oh, really?
Named Kel Housels Jr., and his father was to be the original operator of the Tropicana. And it turned out that the Tropicana was really just a front for Lansky and Costello. And when Mr. Housel Sr. Came into the Tropicana, he thought he was going to run the place, and he was completely ignored. And he sat back and waited. And sure enough, the place was going under. And there was a famous story at the time because Costello was shot one day while on a New York street, and it just grazed his head, but it knocked him out, and so the police immediately checked him out by going through his pockets. I don't know quite how to explain that one, but my grandfather was a New York City policeman back in the 30s. But anyway, they find in Costello's pocket a piece of paper, and on it is the take from the Tropicana in its first week of operation. Well, why does Costello have that? Because he's the real hidden owner. And eventually, they push Costello and his people out. And later, when Housel's Senior and Junior and their partners sell the Tropicana, it winds up in the hands of the Kansas City mob. And there was a local politician here who said once that when you tried to get rid of the mob, you didn't like what you had, so you'd get rid of it, and then you might find what replaced it was even worse.
And that's been true.
It has happened in our history here. The Tropicana was an example. I mean, it was clean under the Housel's operation, but then when it's sold, it goes downhill. The Stardust was, for many years, sort of the Chicago family's local operation, really until the mid-80s. And if you've ever seen the movie Casino, it's based on the Stardust.
In fact, it was common knowledge in the 60s and 70s, and a lot of it probably is like everything else, expanded upon a little bit by rumor and innuendo, but there were several mobs ruling different places in Las Vegas.
Very much so. You had Chicago involved at the Stardust. Kansas City had the Tropicana. And you go up and down the strip. Lansky had his hand in a lot of places. But the Sands, which, if you want to call it mob, you can. I think it's a little unfair in a way to say just mob. It oversimplifies. But it's a different New York group at the Sands. And then you have Chicago group was in the Riviera originally. And Detroit and St. Louis were involved in places like the Dunes and the Aladdin. And so you had different families. And Meyer Lansky, in a sense, sat on top. I've always thought if you really wanted to solve the Middle East or any other international problem, you should have made Lansky Secretary of State. If this guy could broker all of these deals between all of these guys who were known to kill people, he certainly could handle any other diplomatic situation.
I think you've got a good point there. It's been amazing, and that's another subject. But let's get back to, you mentioned the Desert Inn, and Wilbur Clark, was he a doorman or something there originally?
He started out, I guess, as a bellman, though not at the Desert Inn. The strange thing about Clark is that he'd been in the business for a long time, and he was involved in cruise ships off of Southern California. And in the 1930s in particular, there were several of these big cruise ships that floated out of the ports in Southern California, and once they'd get into international waters, they could have gambling. And California elected a reform attorney general named Earl Warren.
Yes, who later became Chief Justice. And the conservatives are still running against him today.
They're still trying to impeach him. and the funny thing is, if you wanted to pick people who greatly influenced the development of Las Vegas from outside, Earl Warren would be one of them. Because he tried to shut down these cruise ships. And a lot of the guys on these ships and in the little casinos operating in California got out of there and came to Nevada. And one of them was Clark. Wilbur Clark was downtown with a little place, and he had a small place on Highway 91 that he tore down to build the Desert Inn. And so he's a legitimate casino owner-operator, although there were always questions about whether he was really fronting for somebody else. And when he was building the Desert Inn, he ran out of money. And the story parallels Billy Wilkerson's, except Clark did not have the personal demons that afflicted Wilkerson. Clark just wasn't that good a businessman and didn't have the money to finish it. So he brought in a group from Cleveland, led by Mo Dalitz, but they in turn kept Clark. Clark still had a percentage of the operation, he just didn't have any power there. But Dalitz and company were used to avoiding the public spotlight, and they were content to run the place and do the business and let Clark be out front getting people in and getting their attention. And there are many people to this day who will say Wilbur Clark was the greatest salesman Las Vegas ever had. And one day we were going through his papers at UNLV, his photos were all donated. I swear to you, this guy shook hands with every human being on Earth.
Yeah, he probably did.
There's Wilbur Clark shaking hands with him. It's like, you know, who didn't Wilbur Clark know? And I think I'm it. I wasn't that important.
You know, let's get back to Hughes here a little bit. He ended up living at the Desert Inn.
He was up in the penthouse. Definitely not the outhouse, the penthouse.
Yes.
He was up on the ninth floor, and he had come to Las Vegas after selling a percentage of one of his airlines, and he had a lot of money, and of course Hughes, by the mid-60s, was really a sad case.
Yes, he was.
He crashed his plane in the late 40s, and this does severe physical damage to him, and as anyone knows, physical pain can affect you mentally. And so it sent him careening toward various mental problems.
Right, we've heard problems about him, you know, never cutting his fingernails or his hair.
He would only eat chicken soup and banana nut ice cream at one point, and then he wondered why he didn't feel well, although chicken soup did kill germs. We know chicken soup is a great cure, but even then, he was a drug addict by this time, dependent on all kinds of pills and needles. And when he came to Las Vegas, he was really doing a Greta Garbo. He wanted to be left alone. And when he settled in the penthouse, there are two versions of this, and they do kind of connect. One of them is that Dalitz said, you know, the penthouse is for the high rollers. Hughes is the lowest roller ever to hit Las Vegas. The guy sits in his room all day and night. We need those rooms. Clear them out. And the response of Hughes and his people was basically, you know, this is Howard Hughes. He doesn't move. We'll buy the place and he can stay here. There's some truth to that. The other side of the story, which also has some truth, is that negotiations were already on. And there were people in Las Vegas and around the state who were hoping to get someone like Hughes in here to invest to help clean out the guys who'd come in here with rap sheets. And that indeed is what Hughes does, and he buys the Desert Inn. And I think it's worth noting that the sale went through on April Fool's Day because Hughes was pretty badly fooled in a lot of ways. He lost a lot of money here because he did not know the casino business, nor did the people around him. And if you're going to run a casino, you had better know the game.
What do you think his problem was in that department? I've heard that before.
Well, one of the big problems he had was that he got rid of the top executives, but not the people in the casino, in the bowels of the operation, if you will. So if there was skimming going on before...
It really went on.
It was free to continue.
Yes.
And what's worse... And I'm not going to make an accusation about people, but if you have come up through the business, you know how to catch the cheating. You know how to do it, and you know how to stop it. And Hughes and his people did not know how to do it or stop it. So it made it easier for the guys who were doing illegal things to do them even more.
In other words, for them, there was a real bonanza when Hughes...
You know, it's one of the perfect ways to live. You've got all the money and none of the responsibility. You know, you've got the money coming to you, but you don't have to worry about running the place. Leave that to Hughes. And another factor in Hughes's case was that he had surrounded himself with Mormons. And he loved Mormons, which is fine. He thought Mormons were the most honest people he'd ever met. And he thought this, I think, not because he knew a lot about Mormon doctrine, but because Mormons were always either at work, at home, or at church. They weren't out running around.
Mm-hmm.
So Hughes figured they've got to be honest. Well, even if they're honest, Mormons don't gamble.
Yeah, I've always found that one of the strange paradoxes of Las Vegas history anyway.
Well, it is, and in a lot of ways, it goes back to a guy named Parry Thomas, who is probably the most important, least known figure in the development of Las Vegas.
Yeah, I've never heard of him.
Yeah, and he isn't that well known. It isn't that he hid from the public, but he moved to Las Vegas in the mid-50s to run a bank, and he represented a group of Mormon bankers. And when he came to Las Vegas, he became the first banker who would consistently loan money to casinos. And a lot of people said, you know, you're from the Mormon church. You're not supposed to do that. And Thomas's theory, which proved correct, was, first of all, if you're going to come to a community with a bank and you don't loan money to the biggest business in the community, you're a pretty stupid banker. You're not going to do that well. So that made sense. The other thing Thomas felt, and again he was right, was that whatever these guys had been before or were doing then, in Las Vegas they were legitimate businessmen. And they wanted to be treated that way. And he figured if you treat them right, they'll treat you right. Previously, bankers wouldn't loan money to casinos because they figured when the time came to collect the loan, they'd go say, you owe money, and they'd be told, oh, make me pay.
Yeah, right. They'd be, their knees would be broken at the very least, and cars might be destroyed as they turn the ignition on.
And Thomas figured if you treat them with respect, they'll respond in kind. He was right.
Yeah, it seems to me that is an overriding, if you're writing a screenplay or something, that'd be one of the overriding emotional issues, is all of these guys who had earned their money on the edge, let's say gaming, horse racing, et cetera, they really wanted some credibility. They wanted to be treated well.
I think so. And, you know, if you consider the Godfather movies, one of the most powerful scenes in the original movie is when Don Vito is talking with Michael. And if you've seen the Godfather movies, you know Sonny was supposed to take over the family. He gets killed. Michael steps in. And Don Vito is saying to him, you know, this isn't supposed to happen. You're supposed to go make us respectable. Not in those words.
Yes.
Of course. But that's really the point. And what you find with the guys in organized crime, they don't want their kids to follow in their footsteps. they want their kids to go off and get a good education and have a happy life, and that's fine. But what you lose then is a kind of monarchical succession. So mob campaigns for leadership are even nastier than our regular political campaigns as a result.
You know, you talk about Las Vegas history and all of these people. It seems to me, and I guess history, you're a history professor and written many books about history. I guess history really is made up of people, right? I mean, people are the ones that make it. And, you know, you think about history as events, but those events are caused by people.
Well, I remember a line Sam Waterston had, and I do mean the guy on Law and Order, and he does a lot of historical narrations and performances. And I cannot remember where I read this. I wish I'd taken it down exactly. But he said something like, a lot of people don't like history because they hear the hiss and miss the story.
Mm-hmm. That's a good line.
Really good. And history is a lot of analysis. It's a lot of interpretation, and that's very important. It's a lot of narrative. But it's an exciting story in the sense that we are dealing with ourselves. If you're bored with yourself, you need to change your life. And our story is the story of people, and it can get awfully dry when you're just doing events or dates. And for, as an example of this, I will say to a class or whatever, 1931 is probably the most important year in our history. Well, that year doesn't mean much. Except then, we talk about what happened in 31. That's the year Nevada made gambling fully legal, and construction began on Hoover Dam.
Yeah, we haven't discussed that part. That had a huge impact.
It has a huge impact, and of course, is the impact is the story of people. The people who built the dam. The people who reacted to the dam. Hoover Dam was a magnificent edifice, but the great story is indeed in the story of the people who built it, whether it was the construction workers or the company, or in turn, what it meant to the people here. And what it meant at the time, remember the Depression was on, so the dam was a great jobs project, even though that wasn't the intent in its creation. But when it was being built, when it was full start, when it's going to be built, thousands of people come to this area looking to get work. And it leads to a population boom here. Then add in that thousands more start coming here to look at it. The people who had the money at the time for some leisure say, well, here's the eighth wonder of the modern world. Let's go see what it looks like. And when they come here to see it, the federal government had set up what was technically a federal reservation called Boulder City. And they set this up to control the workers. They did not want them drinking, carousing.
Yeah, Boulder City is one of my favorite places, but there's not much to do there. It's a great place to live, though.
I love Boulder City.
Yes.
I could afford to live there. But, you know, Boulder City is unique in Nevada because it's the only city that bans gambling. And this goes back to the days when the federal government set it up and said, no, you're going to behave when you're within the city limits. Well, that's just great, except if you're a tourist and you come to look at the dam and you spend a couple of hours looking at it, then what do? Well, you can go down at the Boulder City and eat at the company mess hall and stay maybe at somebody's house, but chances are you want to go to Las Vegas and sample...
More vacation life. Right, okay.
But, you know, the dam is going to bring cheap water and power to the Southwest, and while it doesn't mean that Las Vegas gets a lot of water then, we get a lot of water now thanks to them, and it doesn't mean that we get a lot of electricity, it builds up the Southwest, and we're going to be the beneficiary of that. And it forms a kind of an interesting line because the federal government has done a lot for this area, the dam in the 30s, a gunnery school and a magnesium plant in the 40s that really built up the area. Then you get to atomic testing in the 50s, and it's a great tourist attraction, and we all think we're doing our patriotic duty, and lo and behold, the government didn't alert us to the salient fact, and it's a fairly important fact, that people were going to die from this stuff.
Yeah, I remember when they originally started testing there, people thought it was a great deal, and they would actually stand around, and the Today Show even did a live remote one time on a test.
Yeah, it was just amazing that nobody stopped to think, well, what happened to Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Yeah, you're right.
It must be that that only happens overseas. It doesn't happen here. And I'll tell you how much the world has changed. This is my little sermon that I give on how the world has changed. We have a lecture series at the university. And a good friend of mine named Dina Titus, who's a state senator here and running for governor, she did a lecture about a book she was doing on atomic testing. And this would have been about 20 years ago. And she talked about how the government lied. And at the end of her talk, a guy raised his hand, and not quite in so many words, but I remember the question was, who financed your research? He said, well, what do you mean? And his response was, well, obviously, you're taking the communist line and being critical of the government.
Well, I still get that.
Yeah, and of course, the Cold War was still on.
Right.
But if you got up today and said, oh, atomic testing was perfectly safe.
Yeah, it'd be just the opposite reaction.
I mean, not even its proponents would have said it was perfectly safe now.
Yeah.
But that is how much times have changed. And we in Nevada and across the country in recent decades have become far more cynical about the government.
Well, yeah, and then, of course, the big issue now for Las Vegas and for Nevada is the nuclear waste and disposal issue.
And it used to be we would have said, oh, great, it's federal money, bring it on.
Well, Las Vegas, it's a very interesting place, especially since I moved away from there and came back home to my little town where I grew up. When you go out there, you're amazed. Especially if you're not there every day, you kind of get used to it. But Las Vegas seems to be feeding upon itself. In other words, there's no way that the Strip should be as powerful as it is. I mean, it has so much going for it, but it just feeds upon itself. You know what I mean?
It really does. And, you know, it's a vicious circle or a not-so-vicious
circle. I mean, you remember when Atlantic City first came in and Las Vegas went to the doldrums, but that was psychological, I guess.
It was more of a psychological problem, but if you look at this period, and it's a period a lot of people don't really think about. We talk about how Wynn built the Mirage, everybody got well. And that's all true. Well, first of all, most people at the time thought Wynn was nuts.
Yes.
Now, why would they have thought he was nuts? There hadn't been a major hotel built on the Strip since the MGM Grand in 73, the old one that's now Bally's. And there had been a couple of smaller hotel casinos, there had been some expansions. But the 70s and early 80s, this was the period when the mob was being driven out. And I mean the really bad mob, not the guys in the 50s, whatever you think of them, they at least knew how to run a casino, and they showed some respect.
Right.
These guys who were around at the Stardust and Tropicana were not nearly of that culture. And so you've got that problem, nationally and internationally, energy crisis, stagflation, recession. It was not a good time for Las Vegas, and when Atlantic City opened, Las Vegas continued to attract more and more visitors, but clearly we took a shot to the chops. And Las Vegas, I guess, somebody said this to me the other day, and I hadn't really thought about it before. If you think of the 70s, and you think of polyester, now I like polyester. My wife made me get rid of all of it, but I liked it.
Yeah, you don't have to press it.
More to the point, it's sort of a national joke now. These were resorts being built at a time when leisure was more important. And today we have a society where everything is bigger, better, stronger, faster. Instant gratification and modern technology, and look at these new hotels. They fit that pattern. The 70s and 80s, in a lot of ways, are kind of a dormant period. And for Las Vegas, that was especially true. Las Vegas kind of fit that dormancy. And Atlantic City really scared some people, while at the same time, some of them took the attitude, oh, we'll be fine no matter what. Well, if Las Vegas had sat still while 48 of 50 states ended up with legal gambling of some form, as is the case today, we wouldn't really be having this conversation. Las Vegas wouldn't merit it.
Yeah, you got a good point. It's amazing with all of the casinos and gambling business going on now, Las Vegas doesn't seem to suffer.
It really doesn't, and that's partly a tribute to ingenuity, maybe a tribute to capitalism?
Well, I tell you who also I think maybe gets a little nod here, and you've done some work for those people, R&R Partners, the advertising agency.
What happens here stays here. Came up with that campaign, and it's a brilliant campaign. And it's also, again, part of a history, because Las Vegas has always advertised itself. And we advertise ourselves to suit the time. And if you go back to the early 50s, when we got the Las Vegas News Bureau and all of these great photos are going out around the country, cheesecake shots and celebrities doing silly things. There's a great photo of Liberace playing the guitar and Elvis playing the piano. There's another shot of Mickey Rooney pulling a rickshaw. You know, they'd get celebrities to do these things because they wanted the publicity for themselves as well. And if you go back to the 50s, this is not a society that tends to show a lot of skin. And the showgirls...
were showing a lot of skin.
They were showing a lot of skin, but it was, in a sense, I don't really like the term, but I'll use it, tasteful.
Yes.
You know, they weren't displaying a lot. And today... I claim, as a fan of NYPD Blue, that I have never recovered from seeing Dennis Franz's butt.
Yeah, sometimes they're showing us just a little more than we need.
Well, in that case, I mean, I tend to put myself in that category physically, so I hope nobody takes that the wrong way. But, you know, today on television and in the movies, we're a lot more open about certain things. And Las Vegas is certainly suggesting that there's a lot more sex here.
Sex has always been a sell.
But again, it's how you sell it. R&R, with this campaign, and the Convention and Visitors Authority, which are behind it as well, have, I think, hit on something about our national psyche. The whole notion of just going out there and having fun. And you know, there are people who point out, well, we're talking now about conservative Christian values, etc. If you go back to when Las Vegas advertised itself as a family destination, that was about the time that in politics, family values was the byword. Dan Quayle attacking Murphy Brown and Bob Dole talking about the Clintons. Well, Las Vegas was selling family values at that moment. And if you say, well, gee, this isn't going to appeal to groups like Focus on the Family to sell the notion that what happens here stays here, let's be honest about it.
They didn't come anyway.
So it's not that big a deal. But we tend to be a reflection of where the envelope is being pushed. And sometimes we're the ones pushing the envelope.
You know, we only have 3 or 4 more minutes. This has been a fast hour, and it's been incredible. We'll have to do it again sometime because there's so many things that we haven't talked about at all. And, you know, you get into characters and people. And I think that's one of the great things about Las Vegas that I like is the fact that these people are literally bigger than life. Not so much now, but there's still a few around.
You know, there are still a few around, and they certainly were around then. And you get today someone like Gary Loveman, who runs Harrah's, a Harvard business professor. Can you imagine a Harvard business professor running a casino company?
Well, yeah, and you mentioned earlier Steve Wynn with his Wharton degree.
Exactly, and then you get a Kurt Kerkorian, who's really the dominant figure now, if you think of all the hotels he owns. This is an 87-year-old man who drives his own station wagon to hearings and hates publicity. I mean, he certainly is. It gets out there, and you know his name, but you don't see him popping up at world premieres and that sort of thing. He goes about his life, and so it is made up of interesting people. Just as in the old days, Siegel was certainly interesting. Nobody can deny that. But you had everybody from a one-time bouncer who moved up at the Copacabana until he was pretty much running the place, Jack and Tratter. And Jack and Tratter is the guy who ends up booking the Rat Pack.
Yes, he was quite the man.
Oh, yes, and then you throw in the entertainers he booked. This place is fascinating for anybody who likes a good story and an interesting person to talk about.
Well, lots of things are happening in Las Vegas, and we haven't mentioned the mayor, Oscar Goodman. He's got quite a reputation.
Mad if we didn't mention him. Yeah. We have to. Well, he's a controversial figure in some quarters here. I think he does a terrific job as mayor.
Yeah, I do too.
I don't agree with everything he does. I wouldn't. But you know, what Las Vegas needs is a salesman. a motivator, someone who can push people to redevelop downtown, to promote the city. And even when he does things that strike a lot of people as wild or silly, telling fourth graders he likes gym. He got criticized for telling a fourth grade class that if he were ended up on a deserted island, he'd want a bottle of gin with him. And, I mean, my reaction was a little different. My first reaction was the average fourth grader today pretty well knows what gin is.
Yes, that's true.
The second thing is, the real question was, what did Mrs. Goodman say when he got home? That's the bigger question. But that said, you know, he's into it. He gives you a sense that he really cares about making this a better place.
And Las Vegas is a better place, really. I mean, in your field, the education area at Las Vegas actually is doing quite well.
Doing quite well. Nevada became, I guess, the last state to have an accredited law school. And that law school is now in the top 100 in the country. That's a pretty impressive achievement in 7 years.
Mm-hmm. Certainly is.
And maybe it's worth noting. It's named for Sam Boyd's son, Bill Boyd, who's given them $30 million to work with.
Which, of course, helps. Now, we haven't mentioned, you mentioned Paul Laxalt, and in equal time, we got to mention Harry Reid, another man, former DA at one time.
He was a prosecutor here. He moved up the ladder, you might say, legislature, lieutenant governor, and... He is an important historic figure here, not only because of the exalted position he now holds, but at one time he chaired our state gaming commission, and he was the guy who was having the votes to clear out people from organized crime. And one day he went out to his car, and he thought he saw something strange, and he looked, and there was a bomb attached to it.
And I think that happened at the Stardust, didn't it?
It happened to the guy at the Stardust. He didn't know the bomb was in there.
Yeah.
Reid, happily for him, did. And Reid has moved up to hold what would technically be the highest position a Nevadan has ever held, leader of the minority party in the U.S. Senate. And I think the country is getting to see that this is a very shrewd, hardworking, tough guy. And I want to put the emphasis on tough.
Yeah, because he appears to be mild, mannered.
And yet a former boxer.
Yeah, he's done it all.
Has, and I say this as an admirer. I would not want to get in an alley fight with him. He is one tough customer, and you don't get to where he is without that. And what bothered me, too, and I say this as, I'm a college professor, I'm supposed to be a liberal Democrat, Reid is not pro-choice. He is a member of the Mormon Church. He disagrees with the notion of abortion. But he also says, I don't have the right to legislate other people's lives. Well, that would be so nice to hear from some others. But he got some criticism for his position. And progressive groups were saying, how can you let this man be the leader? Well, this is a guy who has figured out how to get elected in a state that includes everybody from lunch bucket union members to multimillionaire corporate executives. If there's anything you can say about Harry Reid, it's that he knows how to navigate the ship through the shoals.
That's true.
And I think he is going to show, before it's all done, that he's a pretty savvy customer.
So you're in closing, Mike, we would say that you're high on Las Vegas.
Oh, I think so.
I mean, it has grown, and it's got problems that first time I went to Las Vegas, I don't think it had 50,000 people in the 60s.
No, it probably didn't, and, you know, we have problems, and they are problems that are normal in many cities. There are problems that are unique to us, namely our growth. Growth does not pay for itself, and the projection is that our population will double again within about 15 years.
You know, I used to scoff at that, but I'm not so sure. You may be right.
I expect that I'll be available for interviews then because there'll be so much traffic I won't be able to get out of the house.
That's right. I guess they're building a train system.
We've got a monorail that sometimes is running.
Yeah, it's had its problems.
It's had its problems, and, you know, there are many innovations we need to make, while at the same time, politically, and Nevada has moved increasingly from libertarian, you know, leave everything alone, to conservative. It's a significant change. We're seeing more in the way of morals.
Oh, and in fact, many people I run across at meetings and conferences from Nevada are conservative religious people. And the religious community there is growing very, it's amazing to me.
And Las Vegas, because of this growth, in many ways reflects the country. We are a polyglot of ethnic groups. We're a polyglot of people from around the country who are moving here. And I'm not saying it critically, but the fact is that a lot of people move here saying, you know, I helped build a community somewhere else. I don't want to have to do it again. I understand those sentiments. But it means that there are social problems that we really don't address because we are so busy being a success and making money. But I think as long as there's a world out there, there will always be a Las Vegas. And other places are going to have gambling. Other places are going to innovate. And Las Vegas will continue to innovate, to keep up and to exceed them.
Well, Dr. Michael Green, I've enjoyed it, and we'll talk to you again. And it's been a fast hour going over the history of Las Vegas, and there's many, many hours there that we could have covered.
Well, please, anytime.
Oh, we'll probably do it again. Thank you very much. Good night.